Welcome back to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Kirk Ott. The guest for this episode is Dr. Karen Pachilis, the editor of the book South Asian Religions, Tradition and Today, which was published by Routledge in 2012. Dr. Pachilis is the NEH Distinguished Professor of Humanities at Drew University, where she has served as chair of the Comparative Religion Department and for 4 years as director of the Humanities Program. She is also the author of, among other things, a study of the Tamil devotional poet Karaikal Ammaiyar, entitled Interpreting Devotion, the Poetry and Legacy of a Female Bhakti Saint in India. We recently spoke via Skype, and after only one false start, we had, I think, a pretty good conversation. Here it is. Hello, Karen. Welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies.
Hi.
We're going to be talking about your book, South Asian Religions, Tradition and Today. But before we start talking about the book, I thought you could maybe tell us a little bit about your background in getting into the study of South Asia.
Yes, fabulous. I got started off studying Asia in college. I was always attracted to Asian art. Art of India in particular. And we had a wonderful professor at Bowdoin College, John Holt, and he's just dynamite. There was sort of an interesting group of people from Bowdoin, actually, who ended up studying Asia, really inspired by John. For example, John Walters at Whitman, Jake Kennard at Colorado, the late Aditya Bell, actually of UPenn. And so I overlap with John Walters, actually. John Holt just really inspired a lot of people to get into the history of religion.
Right.
And so we all ended up actually going to University of Chicago.
Okay.
And studying there. Most of us with Frank Reynolds and to some extent, of course, Wendy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I additionally, my mentor at University of Chicago was really Jonathan Z. Smith.
Okay.
I just liked the study of methodology a lot, and so he was great for that.
And he's not particularly a South Asianist. So
no, he's not. No, he's not. But he was just very encouraging of my studies, but again, really kind of focusing in on methodology.
Yeah, great.
And I would want to mention also Joanne Waghorn, who's at Syracuse. She's also very inspirational and really much more directly South Indian Hinduism, which is my research specialization. And particular, you know, she's a very visual person.
Right.
So, and her husband, Dick Waghorn, has taken some wonderful photographs. So that was really a boon for me.
He's at Cornell or?
I'm not sure where Dick is.
Okay,
Dick is a professional photographer.
Okay, yeah.
So, again, his images are amazing.
Sure.
So I got in that way. I would just want to quickly mention in terms of overseas travel, you know, John Holt has the consortium of the IELTS program to Sri Lanka.
Okay.
So I'd gone to that as a college student.
Yeah.
And then I went to the language program through the American Institute of Indian Studies for Tamil.
Sure.
And so that was like my third year or something of grad study.
That's in Madurai or?
It was in Madurai. So that's been fabulous, and I've been supported by the Fulbright program to go to Chennai and Chidambaram, and so I've had a lot of help along the way, let's put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. And I would imagine doing specific area studies and yet having the mentorship of someone like J.Z. Smith, that would kind of push you to kind of connect your research to sort of larger themes in the study of history of religion.
Yes, definitely. Devotional traditions have always been an interest to me, and the relationship of the religious path to what are the social mores of the time.
Yeah.
And so seeing the evolution that way of the narrative of proposal and response has been the way I do my research. And also my classes, all of the religions. In the South Asian Religions Tradition Today book, this kind of comes through in a couple of ways. One would be what I'm calling the conversation among religions of South Asia. The kinds of courses I teach always have the interactions among the religions. So, for example, the Bhagavad Gita and Hinduism being a real response to Buddhism, for example, in the kind of crystallization of what we think of as Hinduism.
Huh.
And so that in that way, that comes through. I was really wanted to talk about the distinctive cultural identity that emerges from the interactions among different religions. And then I use John Smith's work in the intro to the book, particularly his distinction between presence and representation.
Sure, yeah. Uh-huh. And I guess that if we're going to get started in the content of the book itself, I guess I realized that Selvaraj was a co-editor and that he had passed away before the book came out. But I don't think I realized until reading your introduction how much maybe you saw this book as more Selva's vision, like that he proposed and that you then kind of shepherded to completion.
That's correct. You know, Selva had already written the proposal. He'd already invited the contributors. And the way he described the book and the proposal is that he just wasn't satisfied with textbooks that were out at that time. He felt that indigenized traditions, particularly Christianity and Islam, had been marginalized by earlier textbooks. And, you know, his real gift, he had many real gifts to this field, but one of them was certainly getting everyone to really pay attention to Christianity in India as an Indian tradition.
Right.
And this is totally crucial. And he just gave impassioned academic discussions at conferences about that. And his thesis was that understanding Indian Christianity is essential to understanding the history of religion in India. And again, he just argued that very passionately, very convincingly, and very passionately. And so that was his motivation. I will also add that it was his innovation. You know, some of the textbooks that have come out more recently actually do have Christianity and Islam in, but they don't have tribal religions. And so I think it's very significant that Selva also expanded in that direction as well. The very frequently overlooked contributions of tribal religions to the history of religion in India. And so, to my knowledge, ours is the only textbook that really includes the tribals who consider themselves to be Adivasis, or the first people in India.
Yeah, so the book has chapters on tribal religions, Hinduism, Jain traditions, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Sikhism, each written by a specialist in that field. And, I think something that came across from the juxtaposition of all these traditions and the way they're presented is it problematizes this idea of indigenous versus imported in some way, because it kind of comes across that even within so-called imported religions, there's a distinction between those churches and synagogues and so forth that are funded from within South Asia versus those that receive their funding from Europe or elsewhere. And then within South Asia itself, if you start with tribal religions as indigenous, then it's possible to reconceptualize Vedic Hinduism could be imported at some point in the past. You know, so just these, especially a student coming into a class using this book, the kinds of preconceptions they might have about what a South Asian religion is really kind of problematized and interrogated.
I think so, because religions that are indigenized have been there for centuries. And so even there is a recent textbook out that kind of makes that division, indigenous to India and then indigenized. And I would even say that although that textbook includes Christian and Islam, they still make that separation.
Right.
And that's a separation that Selva just didn't want to make.
I think this
because of the long, long time periods involved, and these religions are really in the conversation in India, and in a way that kind of division doesn't capture.
Yeah, it's. I think the real virtue of the way Selva and you put this book together is it's not just inclusion of those traditions, it's kind of how the whole thing is presented. And then let's see, I guess within each chapter you have this format of There's kind of three main sections for each chapter, one on identity, the next one on practice, and then a final section on current approaches.
Yes.
And one thing that I really appreciated about this way of conceptualizing it is there is not like a section on doctrine. You know, it kind of takes that out of the, you know, doctrine. It only comes into the question of like, how is it constitutive of identity, or maybe how is it observable as practice?
Yes.
So this is, I mean, a shift from how earlier, say, like world religions paradigm textbooks would have been conceived.
I think so, too. And again, this really was Selva's emphasis that, you know, I just agree. It was totally important. Is ideally, this book is, okay, somebody is in South Asia and has this book and is able to understand what is going on around them. And so it is very heavily on practice, on what the kinds of things that you'll see and what you need to know in order to understand that. And so I think that's, you know, that's really central here. Another way that Selva phrased it is kind of blurring the boundary between popular and elite, because that's too, you know, dichotomous, again, the dichotomous categories that don't really work when you're there in the midst, seeing people. And so, again, our emphasis is really, it's on conversations, it's on shared reality plus distinctiveness within that, as these religions really chalk out their own perspectives. It's about Diana Eck's idea of pluralism and polycentric India, that one does not mean the same thing in India as it does in the West. And also even Amartya Sen's idea of argumentative Indian. And so all of these groups together, visible in India. Again, it's not a volume that was trying to get every single religion into it. It was really kind of main conversations of the South Asian region for students.
Yeah, I think this way of presenting it makes it really useful in terms of in the classroom. I can imagine that the kinds of discussions that it facilitates in the class would be different than the maybe what a lot of students would expect coming in and just wanting to know, like, you know, what does Islam say about X or something? You know, it kind of takes it, those questions don't even make sense when you start from this book as
This is something that I'm kind of really thinking about now. As the you know, raison d'etre of the humanities is really pretty consistently questioned in some circles here in the U.S. And, you know, what I'm really emphasizing to my students, and this book is very helpful in doing that, is we're not making lists here. We're talking about people engaged with their own communities and with others. And it's a nuanced kind of approach. Why would somebody say this? You know, how does it relate to the way the community identifies itself and then identifies itself within a wider context? And so if people are expecting to come in, and people aren't in my classes because they know me at this point, I've been in for over 20 years. You know, I we're not going to do the social science, you know, here's the list kind of thing. Here's what to look for. It's a lot of rhetorical study, right? What people say, what people are doing in context. And Thomas Tongarange's very interesting, nuanced discussion of Christian identity. That's one of the things I really loved about his chapter, talking about the two loyalties of Indian Christian, talking about Indian Christians taking Christian names, significance of that, and then the way the architecture really relates to the Indian context, and yet is very distinctive, as well.
Yeah, I think between the opening chapter on tribal religions and then reading Tongarage's chapter on Christianity in South Asia, each of those chapters kind of mentioned this issue of, well, when tribals convert to Christianity? Do they still are they still eligible for the kind of scheduled caste, you know, help from
that's
the government?
That's a huge issue.
And so what kind of a category is, you know, caste or religion in that?
Yeah.
And I don't think either of those authors seem to be aware of each other or deliberately bringing this up, but just the way the book kind of asks those questions, it's almost impossible
Exactly. Yeah, it means that, you know, ultimately identity is very fluid.
Yeah.
It needs to be worked out, or to kind of evoke language that Jonathan Smith uses, that, you know, things are made. They're not just received. Homo faber, right?
Right. Yeah.
And so this is what we're really after here, is how do people make identity?
Mm-hmm.
And we see that some things that are really thought to be very inherited and fixed in Indian, in particular Indian culture, again, you just mentioned caste, turns out to be a lot more fluid and a lot more malleable, and people can really make decisions about that and their perspective on that. And we find that within tribals and Christianity, very pronounced, it seems to me.
Yeah.
You know, I did for the first time actually teach with this textbook last fall, and the students were picking up on a lot of these issues. People really actually loved the tribals chapter, because, you know, people don't hear about it so much.
Yeah.
And in particular, it was just so interesting the way the Orion myth you know, just spoke to the values of agriculture and connection to the land, and what with the whole emphasis on kind of, you know, ecology and religion now, I think people really in particular enjoyed that chapter. So it's a very indigenous identity, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you mentioned earlier this focus on kind of, you know, if you were on the ground in South Asia, looking around you, you know, what would you see in terms of what people do? And that's really the sense I got coming away from this text, is it was kind of the view of humans rather than the view from within abstract ideas or something like that.
Thanks. Yeah, what people do.
Right, yeah.
And I guess, you know, on that theme also, one of my kind of favorite chapters on that is Vasudha Narayanan's chapter on Hinduism. The students were really impressed with the way she described Hinduism being inflected through really diverse cultural activities that are not necessarily, at least not to my students, not on the surface religious. So for food, people loved hearing about food.
Right, yeah.
About horoscope, actually. That's not something you hear so much about, but that is a practice, a major practice. And dance and music.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting some experience with dance over here, Bart. Not Diem has really taken off. So actually, you know, my students do have opportunities here in the New York City area to see Bart Not Diem.
Sure,
and I've brought Bart Not Diem dancers onto campus here. Siona Benjamin is fantastic. She's an artist, but she did a performance piece with Bharat Natyam dancer Ramnarayan, actually from the Mritanjali Dance School here in New Jersey, has danced here several times, and she's just fabulous. You know, this way the students can bring this sense of lived tradition to their studies, but also then to experiences they may well have in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's nice how these same kinds of themes kind of pop up in each chapter, like how do dietary rules help to solidify identity, you know, it's not as if the text is formulaic in having, like, you know, talking about each of these things, but they just kind of come up.
We wanted kind of a same perspective, so lived tradition, and we have those main themes, identity and current topics, but within it, again, we really didn't want to regiment, you know, okay, what, you know, here's You know, go to page, right. go to the third page in every article, right. get something yeah. about food, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But food shows up, for example, yeah. like I'm thinking of Whitney Kelting's wonderful discussion of Jainism and the domestic context of fasting.
Right.
It's a very, very interesting. She really gives an impression of the blending of sort of elite and popular in her, the introduction she gives us to Jainism, mm-hmm. which again is really refreshing because so often you see that in Jainism in particular, it's really presented as sort of a dichotomy
yeah.
and between monastic, for example, and lay people. Mm-hmm. And with Whitney's chapter, we really, you know, don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
We see it all in the mix at temples, and in terms of people's interactions, mm-hmm. Et cetera. And
yeah,
so that for me is kind of refreshing.
One of the virtues of starting each chapter with a discussion of identity is it forces you to kind of step back and think about, you know, who's going to be included in this category before just jumping
yes.
right into,
yes.
like I was thinking of the chapter on Judaisms
mm-hmm.
and the different ways that Jewish communities within South Asia may have very different relationships to, you know, the modern state of Israel or to British colonialism during that period in history, that there's not kind of a unified South Asian Jewishness, you know, it's
exactly.
contested.
Exactly. And, you know, he, you know, is very upfront in saying mm-hmm. that these aren't, you know, sort of, you know, extravagant, thriving communities
right.
in he's talking about Western India
right.
Today. But he does supply us with these wedding songs.
Oh, right.
Which, again, sort of show this the intertwining
mm-hmm.
Of local, particularly Kerala,
mm-hmm.
Indian traditions and also Jewish traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So there's these wonderful descriptions of this sort of, what is it, dressed in gold.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of describes a Kerala style of wedding, but it is part of sort of this Jewish tradition in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I also really liked in his chapter this sense of young Israelis,
yeah.
the diversity of Jewish people who are coming to India and South Asia today, the Chabad Lubavitch movement,
mm-hmm.
and then these young Israelis who come as well. I think there's you know, that was actually kind of real interest to some of my students who actually wanted to pursue that further, right? Why?
Sure.
Why India?
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of, that gave sort of my students a further study topic, actually, is just to look at that.
Yeah, this is when, when young Israelis are finished with their compulsory
yes,
military
yes.
service and they go backpacking and
mm-hmm.
I guess there's a center around Goa or around the beach
mm-hmm.
area.
Yes, in that
yeah.
Western
yeah.
India, yeah.
And the chapters each end with some discussion questions and a set of key terms, like a glossary.
Yes.
And
yeah.
there's also, within each chapter, some like box text of a particular
yeah.
case study or something.
Yeah, which we had just pointed to with the diversity of Jewish people
yeah.
in India today is one of those text boxes. Yeah, you know, and I use that. I use those lists in the back. It's about 10 terms,
mm-hmm.
10 central terms, list of terms. I use that, and it was really convenient because I just said, okay, well, you know, have for the midterm, for example, you have to know those terms.
Right.
And so I have to say that was really, really convenient
yeah.
rather than writing them all myself, like I've done every other year.
Yeah.
And I also, the list of sources, good quality next step readings,
mm-hmm.
Actually, so that people, students and anyone else who's reading the book will know where to go. As a next step, something accessible and meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll also, in that regard, you know, I had a lot of fun with the contributors in developing uh-huh. the kind of the more arts-oriented resources that I have at the end of the intro.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So films.
Mm-hmm.
And literature,
mm-hmm.
Salman Rushdie and others, and then art online. Just so people have that as a resource for visuals, and then the creative interpretation of tradition through the literature in particular. And then really, if you're not standing in South Asia with this book, then the next best is, you know, seeing a film. Holding this book in the classroom. And so I really enjoyed that. And I also, I'll say one thing about the beginning of each chapter. That I really was the person who said, you know, I really want to have a map. Because when I was reading, this had to do with my textbook experience. Because an awful lot of this was Selva's textbook experience. This one was mine.
Right.
Reading books, textbooks where you had no idea where the author was talking about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's one thing to be able to locate New Delhi on the map, right? Mm-hmm. You can... you know, any map's going to show you that. But what about Nazareth in South India, which is important for a discussion of Christianity in India? And so I just said, okay, well, we're going to have maps so that the students are going to know exactly when Thomas Thongaraj talks about Nazareth, they're going to know exactly where that is in India. And so I just find for someone's orientation, right, that matters a lot. And so I was really, credit for that.
That's a feature I really appreciated, actually, because it's not simply that maps are included. It's that this is the first page of each chapter a map of the South Asian region with, you know, indicating what are the major regions or cities that are going to be discussed. And it just creates such a different feeling going into the chapter rather than, say, if you had a timeline or a list of sacred texts or something. Gets you thinking along different lines going into each chapter.
And where people are living.
Right.
You know, it's living people centric.
I don't know. I guess it's a while ago now that you went through the editorial process, but is there anything about your work with the contributors in terms of, asking them to, conform to this kind of identity practice, current approaches, structure, or what did you invite them to include in terms of a box text, like what would be appropriate, or what kinds of questions did you, or prompts did you use?
That's a great question. Yeah. I was just so grateful that they all were very enthusiastic to continue with the project because my understanding is that nothing had been written. People had agreed to do it, but there had been a little bit of a time lag, and then, Selva passed away untimely. And so it had been a while, and, writing these kind of textbook articles is not easy. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's very, very skilled because you're trying to get to the essence of the tradition, and yet you're not going to want to essentialize.
Right.
Yeah. So I, all these people, I'm just are just incredibly high level scholars, pioneers in their fields. Mm. And I thought they were the right people, or I really agreed with Selva, because they are people who are very, very advanced in their fields and advanced enough to reach back to the intro level. And I just was so grateful that they wanted to continue doing this. And I did run by them this idea of identity, this idea of kind of how the tradition sets itself up in terms of its claims to universality. You know, it is including everybody. And then the practice, definitely. And then the kind of current approaches. They all agreed with that as a way of doing things. And some people in the current approaches kind of talked about some issues in the religion, particularly women, and some of them with status of women.
Yeah.
And some people also kind of did a little bit of a history of the study. So that you got, some names of scholars who you could go to for this study. So the framework was there, and it was agreed on by all of the contributors.
Okay.
But they really did with it.
Yeah.
What was meaningful for the tradition they were covering and the kind of style that they have. I was really quite pleased with that.
And concluding with the current approaches section, especially for those chapters that talk more about the academic approaches, I think this. And they're brief sections. It's not going to burden the student with a lot of scholarly apparatus, but it just gives a hint of the knowledge that we have about these traditions are always a result of human scholars making methodological decisions and including or excluding certain data. And it just kind of pulls the curtain back a little bit that this isn't just like an encyclopedia article that comes out of nowhere. It's mm-hmm. written by a person with certain interests and a certain viewpoint, and that's how our understanding of religions always come about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and even I'm just sort of thinking about Pashara Singh's chapter on Sikhism, and that he really takes up the issue of multiple identities within Sikhism in that last section, and really, you know, acknowledges that there are many different ways to define a Sikh person, that some people adopt a certain dress, some people do not, for example, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Current approaches, I like how it can be either current academic approaches to the study or even current approaches of practitioners within the religion. What are the things that they are concerned with? You know,
exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, and another one of the things that was particularly striking about that chapter for my students is the way the Adi Granth sacred scripture is the Guru today.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's a different way of thinking about scripture, because that's part of what Dr. Singh is dealing with in that last section of current approaches, is that this doesn't necessarily fit neatly into some of the categories that have been established. And what was really fun for my students was, you know, the ritual, it's very elaborate. So first of all, we could go to YouTube and actually find some images of the book being sort of woken up and carried to the place where it spends its time during the day at the Golden Temple. And then we could also, we saw visuals on that, totally interesting. And then we also went online to find what passage of the Guru Granth was the one that was inspirational for that particular day.
Yeah, so
that was fascinating.
Yeah, it's not simply a discussion of the content of texts. It's about how those texts function within the community.
Exactly. And that's what, you know, we read from the Adi Granth. Yeah. You know, we were like, okay, we're not just going to read a selection from this text. We have access to that within the chapter, of course. But then this other dimension is, which part of that text is specifically relevant to the day that we're doing this class. And so that was really fascinating. There were a lot of things, because this is a book that really focuses on practice, there were a lot of things like that. For example, we just happened to be reading the Vasudha's chapter on when the Nine Nights Festival to the Goddess was going on. And of course, she talks about that in her chapter. And so there was a lot of kind of synergy that way, again, with the lived religion and what was going on that day.
It feels like this book lends itself to kind of pairing with kind of non-textual resources, like you were mentioning, film, or even more creative literature, like, you know, fiction, novels, and that kind of.
Exactly. If this book really encourages that dimension, I'll be really satisfied. One thing I haven't seen, but I really wanted to, is, and Karen Ruffel describes this in her chapter on Islam, is the Muharram festival, which she calls undoubtedly the most visible marker of Muslims, particularly Shia identity in South Asia. This amazing story of the, you know, Hussein, the martyr Hussein. And it's got an elaborate story, and I know it's a really extensive ritual and in India. And the time I was in Chennai when it was going on, I was out of town, actually, for those days. So I haven't seen it, but I have to say, some of these chapters have really whet my appetite for seeing stuff that I haven't seen, actually. And that, I would say, is definitely one of them. I've never seen the Muharram ritual in India, and I'd really like to. It's very literally striking. Some rituals of self-flagellation and whatnot. Apparently, it's really moving, actually, is what people have said. And Karen's discussion, it really evokes that.
Yeah, and the length of the book, I mean, the chapters are, I guess, 20 to 30 pages in that range each. So it's compact enough that it lends itself to bringing in other materials to kind of analyze through the concepts that are brought up in the book.
Yeah, and we definitely had that in mind because it has to be manageable for the students. And frankly, it has to be manageable for me too, because I read, right? I tell my students, you know, this isn't just I'm telling you to read it, right? I am also reading it. You know, again, it has to be manageable for me, right? I mean, I'm busy during the week too. And so, you know, it just,
I saw this book
got at the basics in a very interesting way, in a way that you wanted to continue reading, at least for me.
It comes across as very instructor-friendly with the format and the extra, you know, like we said, key terms and discussion questions at the end. And it looks it's really
Good. And, you know, it also gave clues to things that would work with each other in terms of what we're covering in the class. So, for example, Sunil Gunasekara's chapter on Buddhism. His was very interesting. His, like the Islam chapter, which really was talking about Pakistan, so a little not quite so India-centric, as I explained in the intro. We really want to make use of the scholars' on-the-ground research. So a lot of this did kind of focus on India because that's where they do their research.
The Buddhism chapter is more Sri Lanka, Theravada.
Yes, it is. Yes, it's much more Sri Lanka. He's done his field research there. He also brought in Tibet for some comparison. And, you know, in his discussion, he also really mentions women. And so, for example, the Buddha's foster mother, Gautami, he mentions her several times. And that was really great for me because I have my students read John Walter's article on Gautami's story. And so we, you know, the students could see, you know, here's where she fits in to this Buddhist narrative. And then we went after that and focused in on the text about her. So they got a sense of the part and the whole in a very interesting way. And that's another way I would characterize this book is the interdynamic of the part and the whole.
I think on my first read through of the Buddhism chapter, I came away like kind of missing, like, hey, wait a minute, what about the whole development of Mahayana within India itself? But I think then I realized what he's doing is he's just taking two communities that exist at, now, you know, and just kind of working back from there. And
Exactly.
What can you do in 30 pages, you know?
Exactly. And the idea that, you know, the Tibetan community at Dharamsala and that kind of, right, you can travel to India and see Tibetan Buddhism.
Let's see. Now, I know that Selva was involved with the conference on the study of religion in India, and I was wondering to what extent maybe did this book arise as a collaboration out of that conference, or is that, am I imagining, I don't know.
No, I think many of the contributors really have been involved in that conference. It's not as direct as some of the other books. So there was a book on vows that Selva co-edited with Bill Harmon, that's Dynamite, on Christianity, Writing Between the Lines with Corinne Dempsey, who is now the chair, actually, of that conference, which is our main person. And then, actually, I have a volume that's coming out, co-edited with Barbara Holdridge. And this is, again, this is the last book that Selva commissioned, let's say. that came out of the 2007 conference. That was the last conference, CSRI, we call it, Conference on the Study of Religions of India, that he led at Albion College, which is a wonderful, wonderful school. And it was just a fabulous venue to have that conference at for those years.
Where is it hosted now?
It revolves.
Oh, okay.
It revolves, yeah. We had it at Drew last year,
oh, nice.
Actually.
Glad to hear it's still going.
We're working on a special issue of a journal on that. It was called Near Divine Co-Stars.
Oh.
in Indian religions. And so that was really a lot of fun. But Barbara and I are working on a volume on the body.
Okay.
That was the last theme conference that CSRI, that Selva led. And that's going to be coming out shortly from SUNY Press. It's Refiguring the Body, Embodiment in South Asian Religions. And it covers a number of South Asian religions. And so we're busy working on that.
Yeah.
But the conference lives on in a number of ways.
Good
through publications and then also because the group keeps meeting, and it's always different. There's some regulars. I mean, I guess I'm a regular.
Okay.
I'm on the steering committee, so I guess I better be.
Right.
It's a labor of love.
Right.
But there's all different people come to it. For most senior people in grad school, all of the religions of India and South Asia are covered there. A lot of them that are not in the book, actually. We have quite a diversity. This year's topic is urban and rural.
Okay.
And relationships between the two. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Oh.
So we're being held at Butler University. Chad Bowman is going to be our host.
Now, you've mentioned your forthcoming work with Barbara Holdridge. Do you have other current research or forthcoming projects you'd like to tell us about? Or?
You know, I'm getting a lot of, what I consider to be really deep critical thought concerning this woman, Saint Kata Kalamayar, who I've been studying for the past number of years. And the Interpreting Devotion book came out in 2011, with the mostly analysis, but then translation in the appendixes. And I've been working with dimensions of that. You know, a book is, I guess, a big rough draft in a lot of ways, right? It's like everything that had to be said wasn't said in that book. A lot of it was, but there's still room to grow. And so I had just recently published something on dance, the dance of Shiva.
Okay.
And I think really bringing in this woman saint's vision of the dancer, and I think that really does contribute something new to our understanding of the dance, because of course that Nataraja dance icon is very famous. It's in any museum collection that's anyone in terms of Indian art has the Nataraja. So it was very fun to be able to say something what I think is new actually about that, using the poetry of that woman saint. And also I've been writing about sort of feminist analysis of classical women. And so I have a forthcoming article in Journal of Feminist Studies on that, the feminist hermeneutics of understanding Kata Kalamayar. And the germ of a new project looking at the currency of bhakti in India today. So bhakti being the devotional religion.
Specific to Hindu bhakti or a kind of pan-Indian bhakti?
It is because, there's been a lot of discussion about diverse origins of bhakti, diverse traditions, involvement and engagement with bhakti. My side of it is really to study the Hinduism, right? Get a little bit deeper into although once you're talking about devotion in Hinduism, you've got the goddess, you've got Shiva, you've got Vaishnavism, Shaivism. So even within that, there's a heck of a lot of diversity. But I'm kind of interested in the currency of bhakti in a couple of senses, right? Currency in terms of is it used? Is it thought about? What are people using that term now? And also to get into some of the, I hope it's not overstating it to say the economic dimensions a little bit in terms of kind of altruism and devotion through case studies. of people in selected professions in South India. So a priest, a social worker, again, it's the germ of the idea. You know, it's going to probably take me 5 years to figure out, the details on this. But I think it's a good start. Yeah. It's an interesting start. It's one that's engaging me.
That'll keep you out of trouble for a while, I guess.
Exactly. That's exactly.
Well, I hope that you would come back to New Books in South Asia Studies to discuss some of these future projects when they come out.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah. You know, I wouldn't want to end the interview without getting a sense of why you were interested in this book and some of your experiences in India and South Asian traditions.
Yeah, I guess my interest is kind of how are these traditions presented in the classroom, you know, particularly to undergraduate audience. I'm currently in a community college environment and just thinking through who takes these classes, what do they try to get out of them, and how do we present it to them, you know? So working with students who are, say, I mean, nobody is hardly going to be a religion major or go to grad school for this. So I'm trying to get a sense of why does this exist in the American university, and what do people look for? Some students are going to become nurses or work in the healthcare industry, and they're going to have patients who come from different cultures, and they want to have a sense of how to understand, you know, where people are coming from. And those kinds of questions, I guess, are what are motivating.
Yeah, and I think I'm glad you said that. I don't think that we have been doing enough talking about that. Anyone who is in any profession whatsoever where they have to serve a diversity of people does need to study comparative religion for exactly that reason. Yeah. And this is one of the things, our Intro to World Religions has become a very popular course in recent years here at DRU, and which is really encouraging to me. So, because it's precisely because we really are telling people more clearly what it is we're doing. And the idea that we, from the U.S. perspective, we have a national commitment to religious freedom and religious expression. Well, that means people are here expressing their religion. And so not to know it seems to me, is not an option. And it's who you're going to come across as your neighbor. It's who you're going to come across at work. It's who your clientele are going to be. Yeah. And it's also, it's very much changing the landscape here, right? We do field trips, actually, in that course. And we just actually 3 days back went to the Hindu temple in Bridgewater, New Jersey, this beautiful, beautiful temple. And they are, of course, getting ready for Mahashivaratri, which was last night.
Okay.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And so the students got to the temple, and the devotees took the students around in small groups. And, really, it opens the door to people to relate to each other on a very human level. And I guess, I think of this book in that theme as well. I think that's what we've been saying. It's really, this let me add this dimension too. You can be standing in India with this book. You can be in the classroom with or without a film or with this book. And you can be in a religious house of worship in the U.S., specific to any of these religions with this book, and it will help you understand what's going on around you.
I like how you put it, that it's not an option to not have any idea about different cultures.
Exactly.
People are going to have some idea. The question is how accurate or otherwise is that idea going to be, and where do those ideas come from? And I think another trend that I'm maybe concerned with is looking at higher education funding practices and how things are moving towards STEM disciplines rather than the humanities. And just, I'm convinced that the humanities are important, but I'm not always sure how to articulate that in a way that makes sense to the people who make the decisions. So that's
I know. And the more we can just talk about what we actually are doing in terms of informed human interactions, I think is going to be a way forward here. I personally, I don't feel it's a sustainable model that, you know, you meet someone at work in this country, and the person says, I'm a Hindu, and the, you know, what the person gets is a blank stare. Okay. I don't think that's, I don't think it's acceptable today, much less a sustainable model. I think we do need a working knowledge of the cultural traditions that people are coming from. And again, our interactions must be informed. And that means knowing people. And that's where we come in the study of history of religions, comparative religion, world religions, whatever one wants to call it.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I really appreciate this movement away from just talking about doctrines in the abstract and towards, you know, starting from human beings and their communities, and then, you know, explanations begins from there, you know.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that.
Well, Karen, thanks so much for taking the time to be on the program and talk.
Thank you. It's delightful to be asked and to meet an educator with a kindred spirit. Right. Absolutely. Well, thank you.
All right. Take care.
And thank you for listening to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm Kirk Ott. I'll see you next time.